This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. It's a full round of stories to get to in this half hour. We've got a couple of stories that are told at the intersection of economics and the environment. The story of Segura Solar of Waynesboro and Harrisonburg's new single-stream recycling process. But we're going to start with the first two installments of WMRA's series on hunger. According to Feeding America, an average of about 10% of Virginia residents in the WMRA region are food insecure, meaning they are without reliable access to a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food. And that percentage climbs in our cities, with an average of about 15% of urban residents classified as food insecure. But who are these people, and who's trying to help them? This month, WMRA is exploring the experiences of Virginians struggling with food insecurity, from children to the elderly, from the able-bodied poor to those who are disabled and or homebound, and the people and organizations trying to help. Now, this first report was scheduled to run in last week's Second Look, but we had a technical glitch last Sunday that knocked us off the air for a while, and we didn't get to hear it. So we'll try again today. And here in our first report in the series, WMRA's Jordy Yeager talks with some of those affected by food insecurity and how several organizations are fighting to end it.
It's Tuesday night, and the Loaves and Fishes food pantry behind Albemarle High School is teeming with people. Old and young, white and black, more than 50 cars are parked out in the lot. About two dozen people are in the waiting room. It's like this 4 days every week. They're here, many with their families, for a free monthly cart of groceries.
Well, we have six all together. See, these are his grandchildren, and this is my granddaughter, and we're all one family. Yeah, so that's why we come to the food bank.
That's Deborah Vaughn, a 50-year-old nurse who was placed on disability after having one of her lungs removed. She currently has a family of 10 living in her Charlottesville home. Six of them are under 9 years old.
This is not fun to carry you through a whole month, but they give like a good supply of food and snacks and stuff like that, you know. And so, we use it. We have six children in the house, you know.
Located in an old UPS warehouse just outside of Charlottesville, Loaves and Fishes serves about 1,700 families, or roughly 6,000 individuals, each month. The food pantry is one of more than 200 partner agencies that the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank provides with food throughout 25 counties and 9 cities in central and western Virginia, from Winchester down to Lynchburg. In total, the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank provides more than 118,000 people with food each month. Just to give some perspective, that's the same as if you fed every resident in Harrisonburg, Charlottesville, and Stanton once a month.
We provided the food for about almost 21 million meals last year. And when you think about that much volume and you think about how many people, it's like preparing for 4,000 people to come to dinner tonight and tomorrow night, the next night, and every night for a year.
Michael McKee is the chief executive officer of the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank.
Think about the impact of that. It's not just about someone goes to bed hungry. It means someone's got to feed their kid. And if they have to buy that food, they go out without themselves, but they may also not have enough money to buy medication. They may not have enough money to put gas in the car to get to work or pay the rent, which could lead to homelessness. We find that two-thirds of the people we serve are choosing between paying rent and buying groceries. A third or more are choosing between transportation and food. And this problem isn't getting better simply because for many of us, the economy looks like it's getting better. In fact, for a lot of people, it's getting worse.
McKee is describing what's commonly called food insecurity, or what the USDA defines as consistent access to adequate food that is limited by a lack of money and other resources. The effects of food insecurity are pretty widespread, from higher rates of diabetes and heart disease to increased school dropout rates. And in Virginia, like most states, the number of food insecure people continues to rise. 9 years ago, in 2006, the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank served 58,000 people a month. Since then, it's more than doubled.
At the end of the day, you say, okay, well, where did these extra 59 or 60,000 people come from? Well, they were working before the recession hit. Many of them are still working, but at a far lower wage. They're underemployed. And then, of course, some still are unemployed.
When we think of people going hungry, most of us probably think of the homeless at soup kitchens. But all of the clients I met at Loaves and Fishes told me that they not only had homes, but that at least one person in their household was currently working. Likely, we interact with these folks every day. They're restaurant workers, cashiers, janitors.
When you come and see what, you know, the clients that come through here, they are all walks of life, they are all ages, they are all demographics. We've got one-person households, we've got, you know, large families, we've got medium-sized families, we've got every, you know, all different ethnic kind of groups.
That's Loaves and Fishes Executive Director Margaret McNett Burris. She says that the food pantry's numbers have also doubled over the last 3 years. Though the growth has slowed down a little bit this year, she says, it gives her hope that perhaps the worst of the economic downturn is over, and now folks can start rebuilding their lives again. She knows just how big a part Loaves and Fishes plays in allowing people to do exactly that.
And so, you know, I have had clients say to us, you know, we don't know what we would be doing if you guys weren't here.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Although the rates of hunger in the countryside are a little lower than those for urban residents, rural hunger presents its own unique problems. The Blue Ridge Area Food Bank operates a series of mobile food pantries throughout Virginia, providing food for thousands of people in hard-to-reach areas. In the second installment of the series, Jordy visits two of these pantries on wheels.
I arrive at the Effort Baptist Church in Fluvanna County just after sunrise for the monthly mobile food pantry. The truck carrying nearly 10,000 pounds of food isn't scheduled to arrive for another 3 hours at 10 o'clock, but already 11 cars are parked in the top lot. These are the first of the 209 households that the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank will provide with bags of groceries today. By 8:15, there are 20 cars in the lot. By 9:30, 40 cars have arrived and parked. I meet a former UVA cook, a man who worked for the Department of Transportation, an unemployed construction worker. But I want to talk to the folks in the very first car that arrived this morning.
Most time we have to get you be here before 5 o'clock.
That's right. 5 a.m. is when 78-year-old Clara Bruce and her husband Horace get to the mobile food pantry in Palmyra. Every month for the past 4 years, they drive about 25 minutes from their country home to ensure they're near the front of the line. Clara brings a blanket for naps and a WordFind puzzle book to pass the time. She used to work at the Comdial telecommunications plant in Charlottesville. Horace used to work as a janitor for Fluvanna County Public Schools. And now, aside from Social Security and a little pension money, they struggle to put decent food on their table. I asked them, what would they do if they didn't have the mobile food pantry? Would they be able to make ends meet?
We may would make it meet, but we wouldn't have much to spend. You know how much. Yeah. Wouldn't able to get much. But I just love it over here because it do help us to save. I want to buy it. We get. And we've been going to the doctor right much because I got a pacemaker and he's got dishes in his bag, so we can't do too much.
The Bruces also go to the mobile food pantry in Columbia every third Wednesday each month to get a similar amount of food. In total, the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank operates 9 mobile food pantries throughout rural central Virginia, serving as many as 5,000 people each month. It began 5 years ago when they realized that thousands of people were going without food because they lived in the countryside.
But we find, too, that especially in rural areas, there aren't a sufficient number of pantries to meet the need. We talk about food deserts.
Michael McKee is the chief executive officer of the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank.
You know, in rural areas, those food deserts are quite large. And then for people without sufficient funds, they could live behind a grocery store and still live in a virtual food desert because they can't afford to go in there and buy anything. So we try to get our mobile pantry into remote rural areas where they don't have access to pantries, or the pantries might be open only once a month or so, to supplement what's available in their communities. Reaching the rural poor is a real challenge because you just can't imagine the barriers to transportation. There are no buses. The car is broken. Where are you going to go? Are you going to rely on some neighbors? Well, there might not be a neighbor with a working car for another couple of miles, right?
Good morning. How are you? Good, thank you.
Everyone knows Katie Harris. She's a partner services coordinator for the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank and oversees 8 mobile food pantries, including the one in Palmyra and the bi-monthly one in Scottsville, where I found her on a recent Tuesday. Harris lets headquarters in Verona know how many people they're expecting for the day. The truck, which can carry up to 15,000 pounds of food, is loaded up, and when it arrives in Scottsville, it's all hands on deck. As few as a dozen to as many as 30 volunteers pull down the fold-out tables, unload hundreds of boxes of food, and get to work. The empty paper bags make their way down an assembly line, getting filled to the brim with groceries, ranging from fresh apples, onions, and zucchini to almond milk and cottage cheese. Families go home with an average of 40 to 50 pounds of food each visit. When all is ready to go, the cars make their way around, one by one, with trunks popped open, as the volunteers fill them with bags of groceries. Though food insecurity rates tend to be lower in rural communities than in cities, for those it affects, it can be more severe. It's often harder to get work and to get to work if you live in the country. Heating costs in the winter are often higher than in urban areas. Childcare is not as accessible, and there's typically only one grocery store for the surrounding area. Many families I spoke with did not want to be recorded. They live in the country, away from cities, and prefer to keep their lives private. And for the most part, unless we interact with these folks, their plight, too, remains hidden. I posed the same question to Harris as I did to the Bruces. What does she think folks would do if the mobile food pantries didn't exist?
I'm not sure. It's tough. Produce-wise, though, I'd like to think that we're able to provide them with something that's trying to, or that's helping them get some more nutritious items into their diets, which are more expensive, I know. I'm not really sure what their other options would be.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
As the solar movement gains traction in Virginia, one installation company, Segura Solar, out of Waynesboro, is experiencing particularly explosive growth, some 1,200% over 3 years. WMRA's Jesse Nadler heads to Waynesboro to find out more about the company that seeks to be more, way more, than your neighborhood solar installer.
Andy Bindia is a born entrepreneur, a real American success story, by way of Romania. Just one thing. Don't call him a solar contractor.
The passion that we have for what we do is the key to our success. A lot of the times people just, you know, oh, the solar contractor. And we get a little bit offended by that because we're not just a bunch of dudes that bolt things onto your roof.
Andy is 31. He's tall and skinny and really passionate about solar. He wears cowboy boots. When he was a teenager, the town in Romania where he grew up was the site of one of Europe's biggest eco-disasters. A gold mining company spilled massive amounts of cyanide-tainted waters, which poisoned rivers and wells and made people sick. The experience roused in him an environmental consciousness. He joined Greenpeace, but discovered he wasn't interested in simply protesting. He wanted to build stuff that makes things right. He eventually found his way to Waynesboro, where, in 2011, he launched his own solar panel installation company, Segura Solar, with $4,000 and a beat-up 97 Honda with a ladder rack on top.
Solar is, if you really think about it, it's pretty amazing. I mean, you take this box, you point it out in the direction of the sun, and you create energy. I think Elon Musk called it indirect fusion. When you realize that, it's like, whoa, that's amazing.
When he first started out, he was doing a handful of installs a week and charging a premium for each one. The company was making a decent profit, but as a long-term business strategy, it was stalling growth.
We basically decided that proliferation of solar energy systems and renewable energy was our goal, was our vision. And we realized that one of the hindrances was the high cost of these solar energy systems. And we were selling at a much, much higher price at that point. So what we did, we changed our business model entirely. Rather than having a few projects with a higher profit margin, we moved in the direction of reducing the price as much as possible on each individual system.
The risk paid off, and it dovetailed with the growing solar co-op movement, in which neighborhoods in places such as Harrisonburg, Charlottesville, and Augusta County go solar as a group, so the equipment can be purchased in bulk, reducing costs by up to 30%. The high-volume, low-profit model has been a game-changer for Segura. Revenue went from $237,000 in their first year to $3.2 million in 2014. This caught the attention of the national business magazine, Inc., which ranked Segura number 376 on its annual list of the top 500 fastest-growing companies in the United States. Not bad for a lapsed Greenpeace volunteer.
70% of our customers do it for financial reasons. And contrary to common belief, they're not all tree-hugging liberals.
The company now does three installations a day, with offices in Waynesboro, D.C., and somewhat randomly, Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Segura Solar opened the Haiti office in March as part of its overarching mission to bring affordable, renewable energy to people in energy-poor places. Only a quarter of Haitians have access to the national electrical grid. And of those that do, they have power only 30% of the time, something like 5 hours a day.
I've started to take my colleagues from Virginia down to Haiti one by one. We have a permanent staff down in Haiti. And each and every one of them's reaction was, wow, we do not value to the proper extent how important and how precious it is to have power 24/7.
For everyone else, they have to rely on gas power generators, which, when you factor in transportation costs to these remote towns, becomes incredibly expensive for the average Haitian. Andy says he can deliver power to these places at a cheaper price and still make a profit. One sub-powered town, Mole Saint-Nicolas, population 30,000, just signed a 50-year power supplier agreement with Segura. The company is building a micro-power station comprised of solar, wind, battery, and diesel that customers can tap into using Segura's own specially designed meters and prepaid cards. In other words, Segura is kind of becoming a utility, at least in Haiti, an irony that is not lost on Andy. And the experience has given him a whole new respect and appreciation for Virginia's state utility, Dominion Power.
So we are seeing the other end that a lot of our colleagues in the solar energy industry don't get to see. And my personal belief is that we give utilities a lot of grief, which a lot of it is deserved, but we take for granted having power 24/7, and it's rare that we pause and say, this is amazing, we should applaud this.
Whether Segura can operate successfully in two separate countries remains to be seen. It's a gamble, but it's also opportunity. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
In August, Harrisonburg adopted a single-stream collection program which removes the need for residents to sort bottles and aluminum cans and all the other recyclables from their trash. WMRA's Carol Lofton took a detailed look at the new program.
For those used to sorting recyclables from trash and dragging out separate bins to the curb, single-stream waste collection seems too good to be true.
When you think of recycling, you think of people bent over, separating things into different, that's just decades of conditioning.
That was Peter Vanderlinde, owner of Vanderlinde Recycling in Troy, the 23-acre, $25 million single-stream collection facility Harrisonburg contracted with this summer. His facility processes 800 tons of trash a day through a combination of automated and hand sorting. The sorting is done by some of Vanderlinde's 120-plus workers. Here's how that process works. Once a week, a city trash truck picks up waste at your curb. It is taken to a centralized location in Harrisonburg, dumped, consolidated, then loaded into containers that are trucked to Troy. At receiving, the recovery process begins, with the hand removal of large, bulky metal material and rigid plastics. Then, waste is sent through a bag breaker, which shreds plastic garbage bags and allows fine materials to be removed. These small materials are waste. Plastic bags are then removed on a conveyor belt by hand. Then, papers are removed by a combination of hand-picking and through a machine that pushes paper to the top and directs it to a baler. At the end, everything is sorted, baled, and either sold, repurposed into mulch or gravel, or sent to the landfill. Vanderlinde touts his facility as the waste disposal of the future and says their aim is to eventually be able to recycle 100% of what comes through their doors.
With us, approximately 80% of the recyclables, this is in household trash, that we receive get harvested. Because we have the chance at all of the material that comes to us, not just what was sorted out for curbside pickup, we believe in the end we get more. the material that is not recyclable goes to what we call residual.
A quick note. 80% of recyclables are 80% of your plastics, paper, and metals, materials that are potentially recyclable, not 80% of all waste. Other parts of your waste, such as treated woods and clothes, are not recyclable and go straight to the landfill. The city of Harrisonburg, like all municipalities in Virginia, has a state mandate to recycle 25% of all waste, a rate Harrisonburg has barely met in the past when participation in recycling was voluntary. That is in part because Harrisonburg didn't recycle all potentially recyclable materials, such as plastics 4 and 5, because the city is too small to market those materials well for resale. This is an important distinction. As much as politicians and advocates hold up recycling as this boon for the environment, recycling is an economic endeavor. What the city couldn't sell, it didn't recycle. In the end, one of the main reasons they went to Vanderlinde is that it was cheaper than going with a landfill. Going to Vanderlinde seems like a win-win. Harrisonburg's overall recycling rate should increase, and
the tipping rate at Vanderlinde was actually cheaper than going to the county.
That was Harseet Patel, business services manager for the city.
County was $50 a ton if we just took our trash there and tipped it and buried it, and Vanderlinde was at $39 a ton. So that felt like, to us, well, we could increase our recycling rate substantially because now we're not just picking up recycling from those who want to recycle in the yellow bins that we have provided. Now everyone will inherently automatically recycle, and more items can be recycled now because Vanderlinde takes everything and they sort everything.
Vanderlinde said it is difficult to put a number on exactly how much total trash is being recycled because every load they receive will contain varying amounts of potentially recyclable material. But what is recyclable, they do everything in their power to sort, bale, and sell.
Our business model demands that we do everything that we can to make the residual as small as possible. We get money for the material we bale and sell, but we have to pay to transport and dispose of material that is in the residual. We're highly motivated, even if we did not care about the environment. If the business is to stay solvent, you have to be obsessed about recycling to avoid expense and hopefully gain income.
And for the city?
We were able to be more green without adding a tax burden to our citizens.
Patel said the new program will have no personal impact on Harrisonburg residents. They can continue putting out their trash like they always have, but more of what they do put out has the potential to be recycled. Instead of a 35 to 40% voluntary participation rate in recycling, there is now a 100% participation rate, which should increase the overall amount of waste the city is recycling. For WMRA News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Jim and Pam Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all our stories from the newsroom. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning.